Blog Talk Radio.
I would like to welcome everyone to John Talk Radio. This is our May 2nd episode of 2015. My guests are Darren and Beth from the band March to May. You can go on their website, marchtomay.com. We're going to be talking about their latest release, The Water's Edge. Darren and Beth, welcome to the show.
Thanks, John.
Hi, John. Great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's start off. This is always a good place to start, and I figured this out. Let's start off at the beginning. That's what a concept I have here. But now, I've listened to a lot of music. I love music. I'm a music freak, a musicaholic, whatever you want to call me. The harmonies that you guys have are something that I would look at as an amazing talent and a gift, because harmonizing is not an easy thing. Working at two voices to become one voice is something that a lot of people work very hard at. You guys knock it out of the park. How did you come together, and how did you know that this was going to work as two creative people come together to make music as one, as we hear the vocals in this group?
Absolutely. So, you know, it's actually great that you mentioned the harmonies, because that was kind of a random occurrence when we were harmonizing with each other for the first time, that it all kind of we all kind of realized that there was something really special here. We met, you know, in December of 2012, just randomly. Beth was a housemate of mine. She moved in as a new housemate after an interview with dozens of people. Didn't know she played music until a few weeks later. We were out on the Washington coast, and I was sitting on a bonfire, you know, Beth and I and some other friends, and I was playing guitar and I was singing a song, and Beth started harmonizing on one of the songs I was singing, and I was just blown away by, you know, how beautiful it was. And that was like this first little spark of like, oh, there's something pretty neat here.
So that's cool. So how do you see it the same way, Beth? Do you remember the bonfire and the first singing together?
I do. And I think it was definitely kind of a spark for both of us. It's funny because I didn't tell Darren that I played music at all when I moved into the house. Partially because I thought, like, well, I wasn't doing music professionally at the time, and I had this feeling that I would need to move in, and either it would be strangely, because I knew Darren played music, that it would either be weirdly competitive or I would have to join the band. And I was very adverse to the idea of joining the band, which is funny because I definitely put my foot in my mouth now. I do remember seeing it at the bonfire and kind of noticing that click in how we were singing together. And I think I remember feeling kind of like, crap, my cover is blown. But I'm so glad I did. And it was pretty wonderful. And just a couple weeks later, we started playing together instrumentally as well and noticed that we communicated really well that way as well. So kind of kicked off from there.
That's cool. Do you guys remember that song, that first song you sang?
I don't.
Yeah.
Do you remember Beth?
I do. It was every song. It's
was
not
fun?
Easy. It's one that's not finished yet, actually. The Turkish song, the Arabic song.
Oh, yeah.
Cool.
Well, that's really good, because I like that. I've also seen things work not that great when somebody has joined in on someone singing. I don't know if that makes sense.
For sure.
I've been to places where somebody's singing and somebody thinks, hey, I can do that, and they get up and it's like a disastrous. But this sounds like it really worked out great, and I'm glad it did. I'm glad that you joined in, Beth, because your EP, which is The Water's Edge, is just really enjoyable, and I've been telling people about it. And I really, I want you to describe from yourselves how would you, Darren, describe your music? Because I think it's interesting to see how the musicians describe their own music compared to how maybe I would or somebody else might.
Absolutely. And it's one of the most hardest things to do. And I think for us, you know, we don't fit into any specific genre. So we floated back and forth between, you know, indie folk and folk pop and folk rock, and I feel like we definitely have a lot of elements of those, but yet it doesn't really describe it. I feel that, you know, there's definitely almost like a kind of a symphonic feel to some of our songs when you bring in the violin and the cello and the upright bass. You know, so maybe symphonic folk, but then there's also like this kind of ambient sound and almost like melancholy for some of the songs. I guess some of the other ones are more upbeat, so I'm still struggling with it, to be honest. I might have to turn it over to Beth to see if she has a better better response.
I'm with Darren. I think I also struggle a little bit with how to describe the music we write. It's funny. I think sometimes I tend to go towards singer-songwriter, which feels like a little bit of a cop-out. But, yeah, definitely that that strong vocal harmonics, the...
So we actually use folk pop, John, just because one of our favorite bands, the Civil Wars, that's how they have categorized themselves. And, you know, we feel that there's some similarity there. So that was where we got the folk pop from. I was having a conversation this morning with a couple of friends trying to, you know, answer this exact question that you're asking us now.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I think a lot of times we tend to rely on musicians who kind of operate in the same space than give a genre?
Oh, it's a, really,
like these guys.
Yeah, well, I totally agree with that. I've had conversations recently, Beth and Darren, with people about this. And I mean, it's kind of a strange time. It's a great time and it's a strange time to be in the music business because back, let's put the clock back 10, 20, 25 years ago, you had the radio stations. You had certain stations that played certain music. So bands would have to kind of fit into somewhere in order to get airplay. But now with underground radio, online radio, with streaming music, with YouTube and all the different ways of people listening to music, the genre thing isn't as important to me, I think, to me, as it was then. And I wondered what you guys thought about that. And also, when you're like putting your album together, excuse me, and you're writing your songs, are you thinking about that? Are you thinking maybe we need to fit this certain way because, you know, this is how they were successful, or this is our avenue of maybe we can get more people to listen? Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. I can take a quick stab at this to kind of, you know, answer at least part of the question. I feel that the only thing that we've tried to do, this is something we point out at shows sometimes too, is that we're trying to write more kind of upbeat, faster, you know, kind of more major key, happier songs. Not entirely, but we realized that in our first like year and a half of writing, you know, a good majority of our songs are slower and, you know, on the minor key, a little more moments like melancholy and sad. But we've never tried to fit it into a genre. We have really stuck with what comes out of our own experiences.
Yeah, I think that I would definitely agree with Darren, and I would think that there's something. When you try too hard to fit into a mold that somebody else has laid out before, if it's not what you're sort of drawn to anyway, I think what you come out with kind of lacks the kind of authenticity. To get the authenticity that really makes something powerful, you have to be doing something that's your own. So we try to stick to that.
Yeah, that's a great answer, too, because I've asked this question of a lot of musicians, a lot of songwriters. And the answer that most of the ones that I've gotten that have had success would say to me, John, if people write music from their heart and they write it to be honest, it'll hit the right people. And it'll hit the right audience. And I thought that was a pretty good answer because I also want to ask you guys about how do you go about the songwriting? Do you share that? How does that work?
We do. Go ahead,
It's a funny process that was never like planned, and it just started to fall into place that way, and it's what we've been doing for, you know, over 2 years now, or about 2 years now. One of us will start a progression, you know, on our instrument, on harp or guitar, which will then spur, you know, basically like a chord progression and maybe a particular rhythm or even like a little melodic pattern. And then that'll spur, you know, some harmonies. And then we start making up, you know, just made up words, but we're getting melodies. We start making up words, but singing the melody. And then last, eventually, like, comes the lyrics and the harmonies with that.
Now, how do you work that into, okay, so we're putting together this EP, and we want it to sound a certain way. How did you guys, being both songwriters, how did you decide what songs to play, and was that an issue at all? I mean, a lot of times bands will go into the studio with, you know, with an idea, and then they come out with a different idea because the songs, maybe the producer that they worked with was leaning them different directions. How did you guys come up as songwriters to come up with the songs on the album to represent both of your views on and your talents in music?
I think that we were very intentional about the songs that we put on the album. And it was actually I know a lot of people go into the studio and write a lot of the songs that end up in their album in the studio. And we actually had written everything that's on the album beforehand and spent time before going into the studio really thinking about and really deciding what songs we wanted to be on the EP. And for us, particularly since this is our first release, I think we were really looking for songs that kind of had a common thread that spoke to each other in the album, but that also kind of showcased a lot of the different kinds of music to be nice. So yeah, it was a very intentional process, and very collaborative as well. I think we there were a lot of good discussions about what was going to go on and what was going to wait for the next round.
Yeah, it was a hard choice for sure.
Yeah.
So did you have did you guys self-produce the album, or did you have somebody help you with that?
We did have a producer, Jerry Streeter. He works at a Bear Creek Studios about half an hour northeast of Seattle, kind of on the countryside in this big old wooden barn. And he produced most recently Elephant Revival, I think their latest album. And he's worked on a lot of other projects with Lumineers and Brendan Carlisle and a bunch of other folks out there at Bear Creek Studios. And so he was just amazing because he gave us some direction, but he really let us take it to a large extent and without interjecting too much of his own opinion, which I think we both really were looking for and appreciated.
Yeah, I think he was an excellent guide in that. Just we had an amazing time working with the whole team out there.
See, that's really good because a lot of times, and I'm not really sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but sometimes a producer can kind of, I don't know if the word would be push or edge you a little bit in different directions. I've interviewed bands recently that have had that situation, and you're in a place where you're thinking, okay, they've had success, and you know their work is their work, and it speaks for itself. Was there ever a time when you had to just kind of say, okay, this is our music? But it sounded like you had a really good relationship, because sometimes that can be a creative kind of a little bit of a challenge in the studio with, you know, okay, this is our music, our name's on it, these are the songs we've created, we're not sure if this is going in the right direction. Was there any kind of that going on?
I don't think so. Do you?
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think that we did a lot of pre-production work on the album to sort of make sure that we didn't encounter that kind of tension when we were in the studio. But yeah, I mean, I think Jerry was really wonderful in he was great to work with, because he was definitely somebody who would tell us when he thought we were making a mistake, or if he thought we were making a mistake, but at the same time very much gave us that ownership over the album. And I think it was a wonderful working relationship, and I think we're planning to be working with him again later this year. So, I mean, we clearly think well of it if we're going back. So.
Yeah, that's very good. So talk a little bit about the making of the EP and the work that went into it and the creativity, because I think a lot of times, well, I know for sure a lot of times when people listen to music, they don't really know what goes into it. If they aren't close to musicians or get a chance to talk to people that actually are involved in it, if you could, both of you could kind of touch on that a little bit about the work that goes in. There's the business side of it. There's the hard work side of it that a lot of folks, let's just say they're walking down the street and they say, oh, Marsha May's playing, and they walk in and listen, and they like it, they don't like it, or whatever. To me, it's really important for people to understand the work ethic side of it and how much it goes into, like, producing and just putting together an album. Could you guys talk about that? Because I think that's something that people, they'll say to me, well, write up what do you think of this band? And I'm always thinking, good gosh, it's hard for me to do, because sometimes, you know, everyone is, they are who they are. Their music is what it is. It might not compare to this one or that one, but I think it's one of the things that on this show that I like for people to hear, the audience that's listening in to you guys, is what goes into putting together an EP or an album. I mean, all the work, the writing, the coordination of it. If you could touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I feel like there's, like you're saying, there's so many different components. I mean, I feel like for us, you know, it started, of course, with all the time that went into songwriting, you know, which means going away on, like, weekend songwriting retreats and, you know, practicing over and over again, you know, like back here in Seattle. You know, I would say that that's kind of where the whole process began, until we kind of reached a point, you know, obviously, as we were going along in that first year, realizing, wow, we really have something here. Then it really kind of obviously led us to the next step. Well, let's record. And so we spent a couple months preparing for a Kickstarter campaign, which was about a full two-month process. We wanted funding 132%. It was a really successful campaign. you know, but that in itself, just a Kickstarter, was a lot of work. And then, you know, just like interviewing different studios, you know, doing a lot of seeking for the right musicians. And I feel like we found the right musicians. They all became a part of our band, which is incredible. But how about you? What else do you have?
Yeah, I think so. I think definitely too. And one thing that I think is also worth mentioning is just the process of recording itself. And I actually had this conversation with my parents shortly after we got out of the studio, and kind of the explaining process of what goes into making an album like that. And I think there's definitely this impression that, like, okay, you go into the studio and you play your song and bam, that's it. You have an album. And that's
yep.
not the case at all. Like for us, the time that we were in the studio, the first round was doing what's called a scratch track, where you're just sort of playing the songs so that when you record each individual part of a song, you have a roadmap, you have a guide to sort of play along to. And then we was laying down drums and laying down bass and then laying down guitar and harp and the strings
multiple
that we
times.
Added. And then and multiple times, yeah, like multiple takes, multiple sort of little tweaks, laying down everything that you think is going to go into the song, and then laying down all the things that kind of get randomly added in studio. Like we added a couple of piano parts that we had never played before we were in the studio, but now we're kind of integral parts of the song. You know, bongo drums, which I certainly would not have guessed going into that process. And that's only the process of capturing the sounds that you're going to go on and work with. And then you do what's called mixing the track, which is kind of arranging the balance of different instruments. So it's like backing one instrument off here and kind of blending everything together into a whole. And then finally there's the mastering process, which kind of adds that final gloss, kind of is the bow that ties everything together and makes it radio ready. And then even after you record the album, there's the process of getting physical copies made, choosing how you're going to distribute it, how you're going to sell it.
On the website.
The artwork. Oh man, like it's a process. You think the work's going to be done when you get out of the studio, but it's really just beginning. And it's both a lot of work, but it's also really kind of amazing to watch something that you love come to fruition like that.
Right. I was going to say that. It's like it's work, but it's something that you love to do, so it's got to be just feel a really great feeling. Now, are you... As you guys are individuals, but you come together as a group, when you're listening to the tracks as they're being created in the studio, is Beth or Darren a perfectionist? And are you at a point, because when I talk to these, a lot of bands, there's, you know, well, we can do this better. And then, you know, track 17. And then, you know, I think if we move and track 18, is that a part or because I'm going through this thing with listening to music right now, going back and listening to a lot of older groups that captured a lot of their studio work live. And they did that because they were – I just think it was something they were doing to be organic and like capture the moment type thing. How do you guys look at that? Because I think if I was – I've never recorded anything, but I would think that I would probably be – well, I think maybe we could do that a little better. Is that something that you just have to at one point say, hey, that's good enough?
Yeah. I would actually – I'll take this one, Beth.
Sure,
so I would actually, you know, kind of speak to the sense that we thought about doing kind of a live recording session, and I can see the value in doing that because it kind of gets a more organic, raw sound to it. But I feel like for us, you know, both because the band members we were playing with were on the newer side, was one component, but also we did want to have something that was very, very, you know, polished and really solid, and I feel like that we're looking for that, you know, in between like the perfectionist, you know, studio recording and the live raw recording, right? And that's, you know, because we still wanted to capture the vibe between the two of us when we're playing. And we were able to do that because when we were singing to each other and doing the scratch tracks, we could look at each other, we could still have that connection, you know, like which we have on stage a lot, to really kind of bring out, you know, the especially the vocals.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think that there's also, I mean, going to your original question about sort of is there a point at which you have to kind of detach from the music and be like, nope, this is like, I could do it five more times and maybe get a better take, but is this good enough? I think it's a very hard, I think it requires a lot of discipline to get to that point of being able to like step back from your own work, which in so many ways, it's like a part of yourself. It's your baby. It's your thing that is your identity in some ways, and be able to step back and say like, no, this is good enough and let it be. But I think it's a healthy place to get to. I think I'm really proud of both of us in the recording process for being able to sort of listen critically to the music that we were producing and say, yeah, like, yes.
Now, Darren, and Darren touched on the part that you were thinking of the live organic sound. When you were putting the tracks down, did you also think how it's going to translate over to a live show and how you could do that? Because there's some bands that put together some amazing studio work. I can tell you one right off the top of my head that he told me on, and you listen to it and you think, wow. He said, there's no way I could do that on stage.
I think there's a mix of that.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely a mix of that kind of, like, trying to deliver something on the CD that maybe is a little bit fuller or like, that's something that you would want to buy in a CD and sticks in a tangible form that doesn't necessarily come across in live shows. But we were definitely intentional about making sure that the instrumentation that we were adding and anything that we were adding in studio was kind of augmented the existing kind of live product. And I mean, one thing that's kind of tricky for Darren and I is that we play as a band, certainly, where it's the two of us, and then we also play with percussion and stand-up bass and cello and violin. But we also play quite a lot and sort of operate as a core duo where it's just Darren and I. And there is we're both definitely very aware of making sure that if you hear us as a full band and then you hear us as a duo, it may be a slightly different sound, but you're not losing anything.
Yeah, that's really good. I think he does agree with that. why don't we play a song? Let's play Embers. Would you like to talk about that song before, the composition and how it came together before we play it?
Sure. Darren, do you want to take that?
Sure. So this is one of the first songs that we wrote, John, up in Orcas Island. We went away on a songwriting retreat. I guess a few months after we met and, after we started kind of playing around and seeing if there was something there. And so we were on this little cabin on the waterfront and, spent a couple nights up there. And the song was one of the first ones to kind of really, come from this co-writing process. And it was still one of our favorite songs. Beth can speak a little bit more to the meaning behind of some of the inspiration of the lyrics.
Yeah, fundamentally, it's a song about loss, I think, as a macro perspective. I kind of, one of the driving forces for me was I had just recently lost a family member and was watching other members of my family kind of move on from that loss and really regain their sense of independence and their sense of self while still kind of always viewing the world through the lens of our loved one. So there's a very personal story to the song for me, but also to writing it. It was a very vulnerable time for both me and Darren, and that we didn't know if we could write music together, and we didn't know if this was going to work or kind of fizzle or what was going to come of it. And so I think both of us, there's kind of a vulnerability that went into writing that song and still, I think, lives in it. But I think it's a favorite song of ours because it's one of the songs that after our live shows, it's one of the most commented on songs where people will come up to us afterwards and say that it reminds them of a breakup they had or some like a friend that they lost, or one person said it was about like a dog that she had lost. It's like all these little facets of how people experience loss and just the fact that so many people talk to us about that song. So it means to me that we did something right.
Yeah, that's got to be very rewarding. when your music touches other people. And Beth, I want to ask one quick question before we play it. Has it been easy for you to write songs about personal things and things that in your life that some people would like to keep personal, but a lot of musicians, some of their best things are things that are deep into their heart and experiences that they've had. Has that always been easy for you to do?
I would say yes and no. I would say that our music doesn't tend to be confessional per se. It's not usually directly about, it may be inspired by a personal experience. And I think in a lot of ways, all of our best songs are inspired by something that is relatable to us, something that comes out of ourselves. And that's what gives them their authenticity. I've always thought about songwriting and music in general as kind of, you're creating a mirror, and songs at their best, music at its best, doesn't necessarily show the story of the person that wrote it, but it shows something that the person listening can look into and see aspects of their own life reflected back. And that's what makes, I think, the song resonate. So for me, it's always a process of kind of striking that balance between something that's deeply personal, but also being able to step back and talk to something universal.
Yeah, that's a great, great point. I was listening to an actress being interviewed just the other day, and she was saying when she does a role and takes on a role, her whole goal is so that someone else can connect with her and see themselves in that character. So that kind of connects with what you're saying about the songwriting.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the most beautiful things about art is that whether it's like visual art or music or, I mean, any kind of art is that element of connection.
Well, let's play Embers. My guest is Darren and Beth from March to May. You can go on their website, marchtomay.com, and their latest release is The Water's Edge. Now, they can they purchase the EP right on your website?
Yes, they can. There are currently links all over the website there. And that's, I would say our website is probably the best place to go find it. But we are also on iTunes and Spotify and Bandcamp and CD Baby, so and Amazon. I mean, any major retailer will have our music.
And we'll be right back with Darren and Beth after this.
Thank you.
And we're back with Darren and Beth from March to May. That was Embers from The Water's Edge, and you can go on their website, and it'll link you right there to buy and purchase the album. I highly recommend it. It's beautiful work, guys. And let's talk about, we talked in the beginning of the show about how March to May came together, how you two came together. But let's start off with Beth, and if you could walk us through, Beth, your starting off from the very beginning, how you got, were you in a musical family? What were the instruments you were playing? I mean, how did your progression in the path through music to today, how did that go? Just walk us through that.
I'm really not from a musical family. My family certainly enjoys music, but I'm the only one who really does anything with it. I think for everybody in my family, it's kind of a novel or like unusual thing that this is what I do. But I started out, let's see, probably in the fourth grade or so, when I was about seven, I started out singing in choirs and really loved it and kind of had a sense for it. So I got bumped into kind of a like select choir and ended up singing chorally and then singing classical voice ever since I was about seven. And so that was always a huge part of my life. And then when I was about 14, I picked up a harp and started playing that. And it's always been something that has really, I really connected with and has really been a formative thing for me. And I guess a way in which I shape myself and I keep in touch, like, I don't know, I become who I am. So music has always been a very, like, very much a backbone of who I am, but it was never in any sort of professional direction until I met Darren. And I remember a conversation with my mom before I moved to Seattle where she was asking me if I thought that I would pick up music again and keep it as a really central place keep a really central place for it in my life. And I remember telling her that I would love that, but I realistically didn't think I would find the right environment for that to happen. And I'm very glad that I was proven wrong.
Now, let's go back a few seconds here. When you said you picked up the harp. Now, I'm not talking literally because that would be pretty hard in itself. But let's talk about that because it's not a normal. I talk to people all the time. Why picked up the guitar? Why picked up, you know, the drums? Why the harp?
I'd always been drawn to a harp as an instrument. I'm not really sure where that kind of that first spark came from. People have asked me since I started playing professionally, and I feel really silly when I say this, but I can't really remember what the first spark was. It was just kind of a constant theme for me. And I was actually a competitive gymnast until I was about 14, and I got really tall, and that's like the death knell for competitive gymnasts. And I ended up having to quit gymnastics. So all of a sudden I had this time, and I needed some sort of direction, and music had always been a huge passion of mine. And I had a friend whose mother actually played the harp. And I think that's, I would really credit to sort of informing for me, like the sort of thing where I could be like, yes, that's what I want to do, that one. And luckily my parents were supportive, so.
Well, that's always good. And how about the logistics of playing a harp and getting it from one gig to the other and getting it to the show? I mean, I'm just thinking, is that easy? Is it hard? You have to have like a van? How does that work?
It's not the wheels on instrument it, to transport. So what I play for gigs is actually Celtic harp, which is for people who are not well versed in harps, which I think is probably the majority of the conversation. What you think of as a harp is often a classic, a pedal harp. And that's what you see in orchestras. And those are the harps that are taller than your average person, and they're just huge. And those are very hard to move around. A Celtic harp is kind of the middle-sized harp. You change keys with levers instead of pedals, and the whole instrument is like probably shoulder height to me, and I'm about 5'8". So it's still a pain to move around. Darren and I bought a car last summer when it got to the point that renting cars was getting not really sustainable, and it was a better decision to buy a car. And we bought it, but before that, it was just this combination of like renting harps. When we were playing gigs in our hometown, we would use the car to go service and bus all of our other equipment and take all of our other equipment down to wherever we were playing the gig. And then one of us would take the harp on a public bus, a city bus, to the venue. And that was always something that attracted a lot of attention and in common. It's definitely a logistical challenge.
People would think, oh, there's an angel in our bus. But, you know,
one of the two.
I always, you know, to me, it's like, I don't know why my brain thinks like that, but I'm thinking it's a beautiful instrument, and I just think it's awesome. I would just think, well, okay, unless you could, like, push a button like Inspector Gadget, you know, and it all goes down into a small little package, it would probably be pretty difficult to move around, but I'm also thinking, like, wow, how would you get it on an airplane? But that's stuff that only I would think about. But
I thought about it a lot, too. I would be with you in that. And the answer to the airplane question is I have never tried yet. I'm kind of dreading the day that I'll have to. I've been very lucky so far in our tours because truly luck, I have managed to find somebody who would be willing to lend me a harp for our tours in the past, whenever we've been on the East Coast or somewhere that we would realistically have to fly to. But yeah, it's not an easy task.
Now, you know, I think it's such a beautiful instrument. And when you're playing it, do you like, is it just become, and I know sometimes I ask questions and I think, well, what are you talking about? I'm thinking it to myself, so I don't know what other people are thinking, but when you're playing the harp, it's such an amazingly, it just kind of takes you to another place, and a serene sound to it. I mean, do you get lost in it sometimes? I don't even know if that's a good question, but that's kind of what I'm thinking.
I do. I think that's one of the things that's always been so compelling to me about playing it is that I do get lost in the music, and there's something in it that just kind of is mesmerizing to me. But I will say that as much as I get lost in just my own harp music, that's nothing compared to kind of how I get lost and how I am immersed in the music that Darren and I write together.
I can imagine when you're harmonizing and you're both connecting, music makes a spiritual connection. And I think that's one of the things that's so incredible to me about it is that, you know, you can take two human beings and they can become one in their music, and it can touch people's hearts and change people's lives. And that's why I think it's so amazing about, you know, the people that can create music and give their lives to music. Now, let's go over to Darren, and how did you start off with music, and take us from the beginning.
Yeah, so I started taking classical piano lessons at the age of 5 and played for pretty much through high school and college, and then and then I stopped playing piano for a while. But I was also doing vocals and singing in choirs and stuff, played trombone, and then start teaching myself guitar a short while later, and that's kind of all I've been doing since.
Now, what kind of influences did you have, Darren? I mean, did you grow up in a musical family, and what were some of the musical influences you had that made you who you are today?
No, my family, I guess my mom's musical. Mainly just vocals, but she has a good ear. She sings a bit, sings like in a community choir, but no, not really a musical family. And I grew up with a lot of classical music, both on piano and vocal, like for choirs and stuff. So that's mainly what I listened to. And then I started actually listening to the Beatles a lot in high school, and then listened to quite a bit of U2 in college. And then I kind of expanded into a lot of actually female singer-songwriters after that.
Who are some of the artists that you look at now and you think, through their music, that would be something that would be really cool if you could get to that place. Because sometimes I think, you know, you talk about the Beatles and everybody talks about them and they see them as a super group now, but they didn't start off that way. They started off, you know, pretty humbly and working really hard. Are there any, like, let's say in the folk genre that you guys are working in? I know we threw around the word folk pop. I know Americana is thrown around a lot. Is there any people that you go back maybe in American roots music and listen to?
I don't really. I mean, I listened to a lot of like Tori Amos and Sarah McLachlan for a while, but I feel like now I feel like so much of my influence in terms of who I listen to is so much of a lot of local artists here in Seattle. So I don't really go back to any of the classics or any roots or any Americana per se, except for the folks that I know that are singing that genre here in Seattle.
No, one of the that made an interesting point, Darren, because when I've interviewed people from all over, I've had the opportunity to interview people from all over the world and people that have started in one area and moved to a different area, and I was thinking about, does geography really have anything to do with people's sound? Because it's a physical place and music is a spiritual thing. Do you guys think it does? Do you think? Let's ask Darren first. Do you think the way that you create music and the way that your song write, is it affected by geography?
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I mean, you know, that Seattle is obviously very, very green and lush and a lot of water, and I think that that's plays a pretty big influence in the songs that we write. I grew up in Maine, actually, and so, you know, it's somewhat similar in terms of being surrounded by a lot of green and water, and I think that really influences what we write and the audience that, you know, the local audience here that I think really appreciates it, versus if we're in Southern California, our music might not actually go over that well. You know, it's hard to say.
Well, what do you think, Beth?
I think I'd agree with Darren in that our music is definitely... Like, there's definitely a strong element of the Pacific Northwest that inspires us, and I think our music is definitely kind of in conversation with a lot of the other music that is going on in our area. But I also think that, I mean, going back to something that we were talking about earlier around sort of music and when it's getting it right, it's about connection. People all over the world say something about our music really speaks to them, and maybe it's not what someone would listen to if they were in a different place, because it's not music from there, but there's something there. It goes back to that universal element, and in good songwriting, is that if something speaks to you, it speaks to you. It doesn't matter if it's in your language or if it's the kind of music that you're accustomed to listening to. There's something there.
Well, I think that's an amazing point, because what has happened in with the music and the internet has changed everything. Because what will happen a lot of times when I do research on music, and I'll see that there were musicians that were amazingly famous and known in their region, but it never got any farther than their region. But now, not an obstacle like it used to be. You could play and have really an amazing crowd. Let's say Seattle or Chicago or you know, in Memphis or places like that. But now with the internet and with people being able to stream music from all over the world, you talked about people listening to your music from all over. It's not that big of a challenge now, because people can access your music. What do you guys think about that? There's so much out there. I mean, there's so much music out there that people can listen to. They want to listen to March to May, but then there's all these other artists to choose from. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, or both? Let's go with
Darren, Beth. Darren, do you want to take that? Okay. Personally, I would say that I think it's a good thing. I don't think that when you listen to music, I don't think it's competitive. I think that's just the most simple way to put it, in that I think about myself as a listener, and I listen to a lot of different musicians, and the fact that I listen to one musician doesn't mean that that for some reason, like, the limited resource of my music attention, like, doesn't go to somebody else. If I like the music, I'll listen to it. And on one hand, I think that it presents different challenges in sort of getting your music to different audiences, because, yeah, it's like there are a lot of people trying to do similar things, and maybe not write the same music, but trying to reach the same audience at the same time. And so it becomes a little bit trickier, but at the same time, it's, I think, huge opportunities open up for accessing that audience and figuring out who your audience is, that weren't there before. I mean, before you sort of depended on a record label to decide who your audience was and market to that audience. And it's much more democratic now, I think.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think that it brings up some interesting questions also. When you guys put your music out, do you was it considered to do it for free? Because a lot of artists do that. And the idea is, okay, we invested a lot of money in this, and we're musicians, so we should be able to get paid for what we do, and I 100% agree with that. But then there have been musicians that have taken that stand. We're going to put our music out there for free so people can listen to it, so we can use it as a marketing device to get people to listen to it, and then maybe, you know, establish a base of people and then go from there. How do you guys approach that part? Because it comes into the business side of music.
It's funny. So I'll jump in and answer this, because I think we just we may be changing our own approach to it a little bit. I read a book recently, actually, by a guy named Cory Doctorow on distributing art and music, and that idea of like how do things change with digital distribution. And it was fascinating, and it really made a strong argument for that free element. Right now, if you go to our Bandcamp page, which links from our website, Embers, the song that played last, is currently a Pay What You Will, which is as close as you can get on Bandcamp to making something free. And so we have that going. And we are also trying to get our music out on as many streaming services as possible, because especially as artists at this stage, we may still sell the physical copy, but for digital distribution, for a download, that doesn't cost us anything. And if it means that if selling it or offering it for free means that more people are going to be connecting with our music and listening to our music and really being moved by it and starting to pay attention, that's wonderful.
That's always something that I've had, you know, controversy on when I've talked to different musicians. I had one guy just flat out tell me, nobody's getting any of our music unless they pay for it, period. It's not free for us to do, you know, our instruments aren't free, our studio isn't free. And so I thought, I can't really argue with that. And then I've had a group on from Philadelphia that has never asked for a penny of any of their music. And somehow, you know, they're doing really well. So, Darren, how do you think, with the music scene as it is right now, how do you think Marcia May fits in, and what's your strategy going forward?
It's a good question, John. I feel like that, you know, we are right now, like Beth was saying, debating, you know, in terms of how much to give away, how much not to give away. I think we'll probably find a balance in between of, you know, giving away some music and selling, you know, because I think when we're at a show and we're playing a show, people want to buy a CD, you know, so that's
yep.
a great place to,
that's good. Yep.
to sell the music there. But in terms of the larger picture and, you know, giving away music or having periods of time where we give away music, I think that's definitely beneficial and, you know, kind of the direction that we're going to go to get heard, you know, to start building a following. And, you know, I think also having like ambassadors and, you know, in a sense in different cities and countries and places around the world that can speak to what we do and can start, you know, sharing our music with other people to build a following in those different places is a pretty pretty instrumental thing to also do in terms of getting our music out there. You know, we're also going to be working with a licensing agent to get music out to films, TVs, video games, anything along those lines, and you know, see if we can start to get placements in some of those areas, because I think that would also kind of get our music out there to a pretty wide audience.
Yeah, I'm always, when I watch a television show, Darren, and there's a really cool song on, I always do the Shazam thing on it to see who the artist is, because I think that's a really good way for musicians to get their music out now, too, and, you know, to get known, and yeah, it's a really great thing. Well, I want to thank both of you for being on the show. I've had a great time talking to you, and I wish the best for you. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
I think just thank you guys again so much for having us on the show. It's been
a
real pleasure.
It's my pleasure, and thank you so
much.
Much
appreciated.
Well, I wish the best, and if you guys, I'm in Ohio, so if you come this way, we have a big university here, which has a lot of places for people to play, and I don't know if you've heard of the Ohio State University. It's a little school
Yeah.
right here, in but it's got great music. I mean, there's just areas where there's just clubs and bars that have, really, and a lot of folks like to spend their time listening to the diverse music we have in here. So if you ever come this way, let me know. It'd be great.
Excellent. Thanks, John.
Well, thank you, and I want to thank everyone for listening to John Talk Radio tonight. And you can go to marchtomay.com and learn all about the group, Darren and Beth, their beautiful music they put together, and please support the band. And thanks so much, guys, for being on the show tonight, and we'll talk to everyone later.
Thank you, John.
I hear the rain upon the roof, comforting, and hold me tightly.